Imagine standing in the heart of Paris in the late 1880s. The city is a whirlwind of horse-drawn carriages. Gas lamps flicker along the grand boulevards, and the air is buzzing with the excitement of a new era. The world is on the brink of the 20th century, a time of incredible invention and industrial power. And Paris is about to host a massive fair to show it all off, the 1889 Exposition Universelle, a celebration marking the 100th anniversary of the French Revolution. The centerpiece of this fair needs to be something spectacular, something the world has never seen before. A competition is held, and over 100 artists and engineers submit their wild ideas. But one design is so audacious, so radically different, that it seems almost impossible. It's a plan for a tower made not of traditional stone or brick, but of a naked industrial skeleton of iron, soaring 1,000 feet into the sky, a height that would make it the tallest man-made structure on Earth by a staggering margin. To many Parisians, the idea was a horror. They called it a truly tragic street lamp, a gigantic black smokestack, a monstrous and useless blot on their beautiful city. They feared it would be an eyesore, a cold, rigid latticework of metal that had no place among the elegant stone cathedrals and palaces. And yet, against all the protests, the project went forward. For the next 2 years, the people of Paris watched as this impossible tower began to rise from the ground piece by piece, like a giant's Meccano set. They saw thousands of iron beams and millions of rivets come together with a precision that seemed more like watchmaking than construction. They witnessed a small army of workers, known as skywalkers, fearlessly climbing the structure as it reached for the clouds, assembling it in a fraction of the time anyone thought possible. How was this even accomplished in an age before modern computers and tower cranes? How did they build something so tall and so intricate with such speed and incredible safety? Welcome back to How Does That Work? In today's episode, we're traveling back in time to uncover the incredible engineering story behind one of the most famous structures in the world, the Eiffel Tower. We're going to dig into the foundations, climb the iron lattice, and meet the brilliant minds and fearless workers who brought this revolutionary monument to life. We will explore how its creator, Gustave Eiffel, used groundbreaking techniques from building railway bridges to design a tower that was not only tall, but also elegant and strong enough to withstand the powerful Paris winds. From the massive prefabricated iron pieces forged in a factory, miles away to the teams of rivet heavers working in perfect sync high above the city, this is the story of how an iron marvel was born. Even before the first shovel hit the ground, the plan for the Eiffel Tower ignited a firestorm of controversy. The loudest opposition came from a group of 300 of France's most celebrated cultural figures, a collection of writers, painters, and composers who saw themselves as the guardians of Parisian beauty. Calling themselves the Committee of 300, one member for every meter of the tower's proposed height, they published a furious open letter in the newspaper Le Temps titled Protest Against the Tower of Monsieur Eiffel. They did not hold back. They pleaded with the city to stop the construction of what they called a useless and monstrous tower, a hateful column of bolted sheet metal that would humiliate the city's beloved monuments like Notre Dame and the Arc de Triomphe. The letter was signed by some of the most famous names in French art and literature, including the composer Charles Gounod and the celebrated author Guy de Maupassant. They argued that the tower was the product of a crude industrial mind, not a true artist. They famously imagined the tower as an odious shadow stretching over the city, a gigantic black smokestack that would dominate the skyline with its barbarous mass. Guy de Maupassant, in particular, was said to have hated the tower so much that he often ate lunch at the restaurant on its first level, claiming it was the only place in Paris where he could be sure not to see it. This passionate protest from the artistic elite framed the entire project as a battle between old-world beauty and the stark new reality of the industrial age. It raised the stakes for Gustave Eiffel, who now had to prove that his creation could be not only an engineering marvel, but also a work of art. The story of the Eiffel Tower begins with the vision of one man, but surprisingly, it wasn't Gustave Eiffel himself who first drew its iconic shape. The initial concept was sketched out by two of the most senior engineers in his company, Maurice Koechlin and Émile Nouguier. They imagined a great pylon consisting of four massive latticework legs that curved inwards, meeting at the top. It was a design born from their experience building towering iron viaducts and bridges for the French railway system. At first, Eiffel himself was unimpressed, finding the design too stark and industrial. But when they brought in an architect named Stephen Sauvestre to add some artistic flair, including the grand decorative arches at the base and the elegant domed cupola at the top, Eiffel saw the potential. He bought the rights to the patent and became the project's greatest champion, submitting the design to the 1889 Exposition Committee. His proposal was not only bold, but incredibly detailed. It included thousands of pages of calculations and over 5,000 detailed drawings, promising to build this 1,000-foot tower in just 2 years. He won the competition and the race was on. Winning the competition was one thing, but paying for this colossal undertaking was another challenge entirely. The total estimated cost for the tower was nearly 8 million French francs, a fortune at the time. The French government, while wanting a spectacular centerpiece for their exposition, was only willing to contribute a small fraction of that, just 1.5 million francs. This left a massive funding gap. Instead of seeking outside investors, Gustave Eiffel made a bold and incredibly risky decision. He would pay for the rest of it himself. His own company put up the remaining 6.5 million francs, covering more than 80% of the total construction cost. This was a monumental financial gamble that put his entire business on the line. In exchange for this enormous personal investment, Eiffel negotiated a brilliant deal with the city. He was granted a 20-year concession to the tower. This meant that for 2 decades, from the day it opened, he and his company would have exclusive control over the monument. He would get to keep every franc earned from ticket sales, as well as all the rent from the restaurants, cafes, and shops that would operate on the tower's platforms. After the 20 years were up, ownership of the tower would be transferred to the city of Paris. Eiffel was betting that his controversial creation would be so popular with the public that he could earn back his entire investment and turn a profit within that time frame. It was a wager that paid off faster than anyone could have imagined. During the 1889 exposition alone, nearly 2 million people paid to ascend the tower. By the end of the fair, Eiffel had already recouped almost his entire investment, making the next 19 years of his concession an incredibly profitable victory. Beyond the artistic protests and the financial risks, Eiffel's biggest technical challenge was a force of nature, the wind. Building a structure 1,000 feet tall meant building something that could survive a Parisian gale. A solid tower of that height would act like a giant sail, catching the full force of the wind, which could create enough pressure to twist and tear it apart. Eiffel, however, was a master bridge builder, and he had spent his career designing massive iron viaducts to cross windy gorges. He knew that the secret to fighting the wind wasn't to block it, but to let it pass through. This principle was the very soul of the tower's design. The entire structure is a latticework, a complex web of iron beams with gaps in between. This open frame is incredibly strong, but also very light, and it allows the wind to flow through the tower rather than pushing against it, dramatically reducing the stress on the structure. But the real genius is in the tower's iconic sweeping curve. That elegant shape is not just for beauty, it's a work of pure mathematics. Eiffel and his engineers calculated the exact forces that the wind would exert on the tower at every single point from the ground to the sky. They then designed the 4 massive legs to curve in a very specific way, an exponential curve that perfectly counteracted that wind pressure. You can think of it like a massive tree, with its trunk and largest branches curving in a way that provides the most stability against a storm. The shape of the tower is essentially a physical diagram of the wind's force, with the iron structure placed precisely where it is needed most to provide support and strength. This is why, even in the strongest winds, the top of the Eiffel Tower sways only a few inches. The design is so efficient that if you were to melt the entire 10,000-ton tower down, it would only fill the space of its base up to a height of about 2 inches. It is an absolute masterpiece of strength and lightness, designed not to fight the wind, but to dance with it. The decision to build the tower out of iron seems obvious now, but in the late 19th century, iron wasn't just one thing. Gustave Eiffel's choice of a specific, highly refined type of iron, known as puddle iron or wrought iron, was as crucial to the tower's success as its design. At the time, engineers had three main options. The first, cast iron, was cheap and strong under compression, but it was also brittle and could easily snap under tension or vibration, making it a terrible choice for a tall, flexible tower. On the other end of the spectrum was steel, a modern marvel that was incredibly strong and flexible, but in the 1880s it was still a new, expensive, and relatively untrusted material for a project of this scale. In the middle was the gold standard of the Industrial Revolution, puddle iron. It was a time-tested material that offered a unique combination of strength, flexibility, and purity that made it perfect for Eiffel's vision. The process of creating puddle iron was a marvel of brute force and skilled craftsmanship. It started with pig iron, the raw, crumbly iron that comes out of a blast furnace, which is loaded with excess carbon, making it brittle. To transform this into strong and flexible puddle iron, the pig iron was melted in a special reverberatory furnace, which was designed to heat the metal without letting it come into direct contact with the fuel source, thus preventing new impurities from being introduced. A highly skilled worker, called a puddler, would then begin the grueling process of stirring the molten metal with a long iron rod called a rabble. This constant stirring, or puddling, exposed the carbon in the iron to the oxygen in the furnace's air, causing it to burn off. As the carbon impurities were removed, the melting point of the iron actually increased. This caused the molten metal to slowly thicken and clump together, forming a spongy, glowing mass, often described as looking like a ball of popcorn. The puddler, using all his strength, would then wrestle this massive, semi-solid ball of purified iron out of the furnace. This glowing ball was then immediately taken to a massive steam hammer that would pound and squeeze out the remaining impurities, or slag. This hammering process also aligned the internal structure of the iron, creating a grain somewhat like the grain in a piece of wood. The final product was an iron that was almost 99% pure, with a unique internal structure that gave it incredible properties. It was this labor-intensive, hands-on process that turned a weak, brittle metal into the high-performance material capable of reaching for the sky. This unique, fibrous structure is what made puddle iron the perfect choice for the tower. Unlike brittle cast iron, it was incredibly ductile, meaning it could bend, stretch, and absorb the constant vibrations from wind and visitors without cracking. This toughness gave the tower its essential flexibility. Furthermore, the hammering process didn't remove all of the slag. Instead, it stretched it out into thousands of microscopic, glassy filaments that ran throughout the metal. These tiny threads of slag are inert and don't rust, and they act as a physical barrier that slows the spread of corrosion through the iron. This inherent rust resistance is a major reason why, with regular painting, the tower has survived in such excellent condition for over 130 years. Though it would soon be replaced by cheaper and stronger modern steel, in the 1880s, puddle iron was the pinnacle of material science, a pure and reliable material whose properties Eiffel understood perfectly and used to create his masterpiece. Beyond its structure and its science, one of the most defining and constantly evolving features of the Eiffel Tower is its color. Painting the tower isn't just a matter of aesthetics, it's the single most important act of preservation for the entire monument. The tower is made of puddle iron, which, if left exposed to the elements, would quickly succumb to rust and corrosion, compromising its structural integrity. Gustave Eiffel himself understood this critical need, famously stating that the care and attention given to the paint was the key to the tower's longevity. He recommended that it be repainted every 7 years, a rigorous schedule that is still followed to this day, and is the primary reason the tower has survived for well over a century. Over its lifetime, the tower has worn several different coats. When it first opened for the 1889 exposition, it was painted a vibrant Venetian red at its base, fading to a lighter reddish brown, and then a yellow orange at the top. This graded color scheme was intended to accentuate its height and echo the colors of a sunrise. By the turn of the century, this was replaced with a uniform coat of yellow ochre, a color choice that is hard to imagine today. Finally, in 1968, the city settled on the color we are familiar with now, a specific shade of brown officially named Eiffel Tower Brown. This particular color was chosen because it was felt to harmonize best with the soft cream-colored limestone of the surrounding Parisian buildings and the natural tones of the city's parks. The secret of Eiffel Tower brown is that it's not actually one color, but three. It's an ingenious optical illusion designed to give the tower a perfectly uniform appearance from the ground. The tower is painted in three distinct shades of brown, which are applied in sections based on height. The very bottom of the tower is painted with the darkest shade. The middle section is a medium brown, and the top section, from the second level to the spire, is painted with the lightest shade. This clever technique is designed to counteract a visual effect called atmospheric perspective, where objects in the distance appear lighter and less distinct due to the moisture and dust in the air. By painting the top of the tower a lighter color, it appears to be the same shade as the darker bottom when viewed from below, creating the impression of a single solid color from top to bottom. The process of repainting the tower is a monumental task that showcases incredible skill and bravery. Every 7 years, a team of around 25 highly specialized painters scales the structure, working exclusively with old-fashioned brushes and rollers, as spray painting would cause the paint to drift and damage the surrounding area. The entire project takes about 18 months to complete and requires a staggering 60 tons of paint to cover the 2.5 million square feet of ironwork. Before a new coat is applied, the previous one must be stripped and the structure inspected for any signs of corrosion. It is a painstaking, entirely manual process that continues the tradition of care Gustave Eiffel insisted upon, ensuring his Iron Lady remains protected and beautiful for generations to come. The first and most critical challenge was the foundation. The tower was unimaginably heavy, weighing over 10,000 tons, and it was being built right on the banks of the River Seine in soft, marshy ground. A mistake here would be catastrophic. To solve this, Eiffel's team dug massive pits, going down over 45 feet on the side closest to the river. There, they encountered a layer of solid clay. They poured huge slabs of concrete, some over 20 feet thick, to create a stable base for each of the tower's four gigantic legs. For the two legs on the unstable, watery ground near the river, they used an ingenious and dangerous technique borrowed from mining called a caisson. These were enormous airtight iron boxes that were sunk into the ground. Pressurized air was pumped into them to keep the water and mud out, allowing workers to go down inside and dig out the earth by hand until they hit the stable clay layer. Once the foundations were set, they embedded enormous iron shoes and anchor bolts into the concrete, ready to receive the first pieces of the tower. With the foundations secure, the assembly of the tower itself began, and this is where the genius of Eiffel's industrial approach shone. The Eiffel Tower was not built in the traditional sense. It was assembled, every single one of the 18,038 pieces of iron used in its construction was prefabricated. Each beam, girder, and plate was manufactured and pre-cut at Eiffel's factory in a suburb of Paris. Each piece was calculated and designed with astonishing precision, with every bolt hole drilled to within a tenth of a millimeter of its specified location. These finished pieces were then loaded onto horse-drawn carts, brought to the construction site, and hoisted into place. This meant there was no need for a massive, messy workshop on site. It was a clean, efficient assembly line. To lift these heavy iron beams, small creeper cranes were designed to actually climb up the legs of the tower as they were being built, hoisting the next pieces up from below. The entire structure was held together not by welds or bolts, but by 2.5 million rivets. Riveting was a four-man job that required incredible teamwork and courage. The first worker, the heater, would heat a rivet in a small charcoal forge until it was glowing bright orange-red. When it was ready, he would toss it through the air, sometimes over 100 feet, to the catcher, who would catch the red-hot rivet in a bucket. The catcher would then grab it with tongs and shove it into the hole connecting two iron beams. A third worker, the holder up, would press a large hammer against one end of the rivet to keep it in place, while the fourth man, the riveter, would rapidly hammer the other end, forming a second head and clamping the iron pieces together with immense force. As the rivet cooled, it would shrink, pulling the two beams into an incredibly tight, permanent bond. This process was repeated rivet by rivet as the tower climbed higher and higher into the sky. One of the most brilliant innovations was how Eiffel ensured the tower would be perfectly level. As the four massive legs rose and began to curve towards each other to meet at the first level, even a tiny error in the angle of one leg would be a disaster, preventing them from joining correctly. To solve this, Eiffel installed massive hydraulic jacks, like the kind you'd use to lift a car, into the base of each of the tower's four legs. If one leg was slightly too high or too low, engineers could use these powerful jacks to minutely raise or lower it, adjusting its angle until all four legs were perfectly aligned to meet at the first platform, 187 feet above the ground. This system gave them an unprecedented level of precision and control over the construction. Building the tower was one challenge, but getting millions of visitors up to its viewing platforms was another equally complex problem. A normal elevator that goes straight up and down was useless on a structure with legs that curved inwards. The solution required some of the most advanced and innovative technology of the era. To get from the ground to the first level, two different systems were installed. The elevators in the east and west legs were provided by the French company Rue Combaluzier, which used a fascinating system of rigid interlocking chains. You can imagine it like two giant bicycle chains pushing the elevator car up the curved track from below, powered by massive hydraulic pistons. For the north and south legs, Eiffel turned to the American company Otis, which had wowed the world with its safe elevators. Their system was even more complex, designed to keep the floor of the elevator car perfectly level as it traveled up the diagonal track. The double-decker elevator cab was mounted on a wheeled carriage that ran on rails fixed to the inside of the tower's leg. As the angle of the leg changed, a series of cables and pulleys, controlled by a separate operator, would tilt the cab to compensate, ensuring passengers remained level. To get from the second level to the very top, a different, more traditional vertical elevator was used, but it was still a marvel, powered by an 81-meter-long hydraulic piston that made it one of the longest in the world. These elevators weren't just a convenience, they were a core part of the attraction, a demonstration of cutting-edge technology that made the journey to the top just as thrilling as the view. Gustave Eiffel's massive financial gamble meant that the tower couldn't just be a beautiful monument. It had to be a profitable business from the moment it opened. Every aspect of its design was infused with a commercial purpose, transforming the iron structure into a vertical theme park. A multi-level entertainment and shopping destination designed to dazzle visitors and encourage them to open their wallets. The commercial journey began at the base, where tickets were sold at different prices depending on how high you wanted to go. 2 francs to visit the first level, 3 more to ascend to the second, and a grand total of 5 francs for the breathtaking trip to the very top, a significant sum for the average worker in 1889. But a price millions were eager to pay. The first platform, a sprawling deck almost 200 feet in the air, was the heart of the tower's commercial life. It was designed as a vibrant hub of activity, dominated by 4 enormous restaurants, each representing a different culinary style to celebrate the international spirit of the World's Fair. A massive 500-seat French restaurant, Brébant, occupied one corner, while another hosted an equally large Russian-themed restaurant. The other 2 corners were filled out by an Anglo-American bar and a Flemish restaurant, offering visitors a culinary world tour high above Paris. These weren't just simple cafes, they were major dining establishments, turning the tower into one of the most unique and sought-after dinner reservations in the world. Beyond the restaurants, the platforms were packed with attractions that turned the tower into a bustling vertical city. The famous Parisian newspaper, Le Figaro, set up its own printing press on the second level, publishing a special daily edition of the paper right there on the tower. Visitors could buy a copy and marvel at the fact that it had been written, edited, and printed in the sky. Nearby, there was an official post office, another brilliant marketing innovation. Tourists could write postcards to their loved ones back home, buy a unique Tour Eiffel stamp, and mail them from a post box on the tower itself, sending tangible proof of their visit across the globe and spreading the tower's fame with every letter sent. The commercial ingenuity didn't stop there. The platforms were dotted with souvenir shops selling everything from medals to miniature tower replicas, a tobacconist for those wanting a cigar with their view, and even a small theatre that hosted regular performances. On the second level, a bakery used a state-of-the-art gas-powered oven to bake fresh bread and pastries, filling the air with an aroma that was surely irresistible to the crowds. Even the top platform, primarily a space for observation, had vendors selling champagne to visitors who wanted to toast their ascent to the highest point in the world. From top to bottom, the Eiffel Tower was a masterclass in monetizing a view, ensuring that Gustave Eiffel's risky bet would not only be won, but would set a new standard for tourist attractions for a century to come. Once visitors reached the top of the tower, they could enjoy the breathtaking panorama of Paris. But Gustave Eiffel had something even more special waiting for him. A small private apartment he had built for himself nearly 1,000 feet in the air. This wasn't a grand, opulent space. Instead, it was a cozy and comfortable hideaway, furnished with simple wooden furniture, a grand piano, and walls covered in warm paisley wallpaper. It was a stark contrast to the industrial iron skeleton that surrounded it. This sky-high sanctuary quickly became the most talked-about space in Paris. The city's elite were desperate for an invitation, and Eiffel received numerous enormous offers to rent it out, even for a single night, all of which he refused. This was his personal space for quiet reflection and to entertain esteemed guests. The most famous of these was the American inventor Thomas Edison, who visited during the 1889 exposition. The two great minds sat together, high above the city, where Edison signed the guest book and gifted Eiffel one of his new phonograph machines, a remarkable meeting of two of the era's greatest visionaries. Today, that apartment is preserved, complete with wax figures of Eiffel, his daughter Claire, and Edison, capturing that historic moment. Once the sun set on the 1889 exposition, the Eiffel Tower transformed into something truly magical, a spectacle of light that was as revolutionary as its construction. In an era when electric lighting was still an expensive novelty, and cities were defined by the soft, flickering glow of gas lamps, illuminating a 1,000-foot iron skeleton was a monumental challenge. The critics had mockingly called the tower a tragic street lamp, and in a stroke of genius, Gustave Eiffel leaned into that criticism, turning his creation into the most magnificent street lamp the world had ever seen. The entire nighttime identity of the tower was powered not by electricity, but by a massive and complex network of gas pipes that ran like veins through the iron structure. For its grand debut, the tower was adorned with 10,000 gas lights. These weren't harsh, open flames. Each one was enclosed in a simple, elegant globe made of opalescent glass. This was a crucial detail, as the milky white glass diffused the light, softening its glare and making each globe shine with a steady, ethereal glow. These thousands of shining orbs were meticulously placed along the edges of the great arches at the base and all four sides of the first and second platforms. The goal wasn't to flood the entire structure with light as we do today, but to carefully trace its silhouette against the darkness. At night, the tower didn't look like a solid object, but rather a delicate luminous line drawing suspended in the Paris sky, its iconic shape defined by thousands of points of soft glowing light. The true centerpiece of this nightly spectacle, however, was the colossal lighthouse, or fair, installed at the very summit. Housed within the glass cupola of Eiffel's private apartment, this was one of the most powerful beacons in the world. It projected two enormous, sweeping beams of light that were so intense they were said to be visible from over 100 miles away on a clear night. As these powerful beams slowly rotated, they painted the clouds and the rooftops of Paris with light. To make the display even more patriotic and spectacular, the lighthouse was fitted with colored glass filters. On special occasions, operators would slide these filters into place, transforming the beams into brilliant shafts of blue, white, and red light, the colors of the French tricolor flag that majestically swept across the capital in celebration of the 100th anniversary of the French Revolution. This gas-powered glory was a marvel of its time, but it was also incredibly labor-intensive to maintain. By the time of the next Paris Exposition in 1900, the age of electricity had fully arrived. The gas lights were removed and replaced with over 5,000 electric incandescent light bulbs, which were strung across the entire latticework. This fundamentally changed the tower's appearance at night, transforming it from a soft, glowing outline into a glittering web of fire that sparkled with an intensity Paris had never seen before. This first use of electric light set the precedent for the tower's future as a canvas for luminous art, paving the way for the famous Citroën advertising sign in the 1920s and, eventually, the dazzling, sparkling light show that enchants visitors today. From the very beginning, the Eiffel Tower was living on borrowed time. The contract that Gustave Eiffel signed with the city of Paris was crystal clear. His concession to run the tower and collect its profits would last for 20 years, after which ownership would revert to the city, and the tower itself was scheduled to be dismantled and sold for scrap metal in 1909. To many in the government and the artistic community, this was a perfectly acceptable arrangement. The tower had served its purpose as the glorious temporary entrance to the 1889 World's Fair, and soon it would be time for the monstrous ironworks to disappear. But Gustave Eiffel had other plans. He was not just an engineer, but a brilliant strategist, and he knew the only way to save his creation was to make it so useful that tearing it down would be unthinkable. Eiffel immediately began to pivot the tower's purpose from a tourist attraction to a world-class scientific instrument. He actively encouraged and funded experiments from his private apartment and labs built on the top levels. He installed a complete meteorology station, gathering data on temperature, wind speed, and atmospheric pressure that was valuable to scientists and weather forecasters. He used the tower's immense height to conduct groundbreaking studies in aerodynamics, dropping objects of different shapes attached to sensors to measure the effects of air resistance. These experiments were important, but they weren't enough to guarantee the tower's survival. The real savior came in the form of a new and almost magical technology, wireless telegraphy, or as we know it today, radio. At the turn of the century, inventors like Guglielmo Marconi were proving that messages could be sent through the air as invisible electromagnetic waves. The biggest challenge was distance, which required a very tall antenna to send and receive signals effectively. The Eiffel Tower, being the tallest man-made structure in the world, was the most perfect radio antenna imaginable. In 1903, a military radio station was installed, and the French army began to see the immense strategic value of the tower. It could be used to send wireless messages to military outposts all along the French border, and even to ships at sea. The tower's importance was solidified in 1913, when it was used to transmit signals all the way to a receiver in Virginia, proving the viability of intercontinental wireless communication. By the time the original 20-year permit expired in 1909, the tower had become the central hub of a growing global communications network. The idea of tearing it down was no longer just unpopular. It was a matter of national security. The tower's new role as a silent guardian of France was cemented during World War I. Its radio station became one of the most critical military assets in the country. In 1914, at the very beginning of the war, the station intercepted uncoded German radio messages that revealed their army was overextended and struggling during their advance on Paris. This vital intelligence allowed the French command to organize a successful counterattack, leading to the pivotal victory at the First Battle of the Marne that saved Paris from capture. Later in the war, the station intercepted a final fateful message from a German spy known as Mata Hari, leading to her capture and execution. The tower that was once scorned as a useless monument had become an essential tool for military intelligence, a silent warrior that helped protect the very city that had once rejected it. Its survival was no longer in question. It had earned its place on the Paris skyline forever. As the tower grew, the world watched in awe. In just over 2 years, from January 1887 to March 1889, this monumental structure was completed. The project was not only a triumph of speed and precision, but also of safety. In an era when large-scale construction projects often resulted in many casualties, only one worker died during the construction of the Eiffel Tower, and that was reportedly on a day when he was off duty. Eiffel was a fanatic for safety, insisting on the use of guardrails, screens, and movable platforms. On March 31, 1889, Gustave Eiffel himself climbed the 1,710 steps to the top of his tower and unfurled a massive French flag. The impossible tower was complete. It stood as the tallest structure in the world for the next 41 years, and the critics were eventually silenced. The useless smokestack quickly became the symbol of Paris, a testament to industrial innovation, and a beloved icon recognized all over the globe, proving that a structure could be both a marvel of engineering and a true work of art.